CFRC 101.9 FM. It is 7 o'clock. We're broadcasting live from the basement of Carruthers Hall at Queen's University on Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee traditional territory, also known as Kingston, Ontario. This is CFRC Prison Radio. We air every Wednesday night from 7 to 8 o'clock. Our signal reaches the following institutions: Collins Bay Institution, Millhaven Institution, Bath Institution, Joyceville Institution, and Cape Vincent Correctional in upstate New York. The last Wednesday of every month, we do a special show called Calls from Home, and that is a phone request and message-based show where you can call, leave messages for loved ones who are incarcerated in the area. The phone number to do that is 613-329-2693. You can also email us at cfrcprisonradio@riseup.net. We have a Facebook group called Calls from Home. You can get us on Twitter at CPR Kingston. And of course, you can get us through the snail mail. Our address is CPR, care of CFRC, Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario, K as in Kilo, 7, L as in Lima, 3, N as in November, 6. So we're here tonight. Also, there's a shadow with us tonight who's learning the ropes of the station, which is great. And we're going to start with a review of the Certain Days calendar for political prisoners. And if you listen to the show, you'll know that we like to highlight this every year. It's a very worthwhile project. And we did an interview with Helen Hudson, one of the organizers of it, last year. And then we're going to play a couple segments borrowed from our sister station, CKUT, in Montreal, and their prison radio show. One of their members of that show got down to a maximum security prison in upstate New York and got the opportunity to interview Jaleel Muntakim, who's a former Black Liberation activist who has been incarcerated for those activities for several decades now. But first, we're going to go to the calendar. So this year's calendar for Certain Days is themed around awakening resistance. So the Certain Days Freedom for Political Prisoners calendar is put out every year by a collective of both inside and outside organizers. It's a fundraising and educational project where the outside organizers are based in Montreal, Toronto, and New York. And they work in partnership with three long-term political prisoners held in maximum security institutions in upstate New York. And they are David Gilbert, Robert Seth Hayes, and Herman Bell. This year, the proceeds from the calendar are going to go to three streams. The first is Adamir, which is a support organization for Palestinian political prisoners. The second is called Release Aging People in Prison, or RAP. And they do advocacy and support work to get elderly and infirm people out of prison. And the third is a more flexible fund that they give out on an ongoing basis to various political projects throughout the year. So, for example, last year, I think they gave it to some land defenders around Six Nations, Freedom Archives, and the TGI Justice Project. So all very good causes. But as I mentioned, the theme this year is called Awakening Resistance, which is a fairly fluid concept. It's made in the context of increasing state repression south of the border, as well as the rise of far-right nationalism around the globe, while acknowledging that this new political reality is also an outgrowth of processes that extend far back in time before Donald Trump or Marine Le Pen. The title essay by political prisoner David Gilbert is called The Decline of Imperialism, Dangers and Opportunities. So as it implies, it situates the current moment as a sign of the decline of U.S. imperialism around the world and offers a sobering assessment of its dangers and opportunities. But as always, this calendar features really beautiful art submitted from both inside and outside artists, as well as writings that come from a variety of people, prisoners, artists, organizers. Great Christmas gift. Now's the time to get it for 2018. It's $15. It's $8 for prisoners. And if you want to find out how you can get your copy, you can go to their website, which is certaindays.org. That is certaindays.org. And if you're listening from inside and you would like to get a copy, let me get their address for you. You can write Certain Days, care of QPIRG, that's QPIRG, Concordia, 1455 Maisonneuve Boulevard, that's Maisonneuve Boulevard, West, and in French that's West with an O, Montreal, Quebec, and the postal code is H as in hotel, 3, G as in golf, 1, M as in Mike, 8. So I highly recommend that. Again, that's certaindays.org. It looks great, and you should pick up a copy. And on this theme of political prisoners, we're now going to turn to a segment conducted by Prison Radio at CKUT in Montreal. They got into a maximum security prison to interview political prisoner Jalil Montekim, and this correspondent is going to introduce the piece. And I'm very excited about it. It's really good. And we have part one and two of four. So there's several hours of interviews that were done, but we're going to play part one and two for you tonight. I hope you enjoy.
Jalil is a political prisoner who was involved in the Black Liberation Movement of the 1960s and 1970s. He was affiliated with the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, the BPP, and the Black Liberation Army, the BLA. He has been in prison since 1971. Jalil was arrested as part of a concerted effort on the part of the United States government to repress the struggle for Black liberation, and in particular the Black Panther Party and the Black Liberation Army, both of which were specifically targeted through the counterintelligence program, most often known as COINTELPRO. COINTELPRO was an FBI program started in 1956 and officially declared disbanded in 1971 after activists broke into an FBI office and gave documents exposing the program to the media. For years, through COINTELPRO, the FBI managed to disrupt and sabotage organizations they deemed a threat to the U.S. government. And as a result of COINTELPRO, many Panthers and BLA members ended up in prison on flimsy evidence, and many of them served decades in prison or are still incarcerated. In this part of the interview, Jalil introduces himself and talks about the basics of his case. He talks about COINTELPRO and how it impacted his case. He then talks about parole and the difficulties he has faced in trying to be paroled in New York State. A content warning for the piece contains a brief description of torture at the hands of the police.
I was born by the name of Anthony Bottom. I adopted the name Jalil Abdul Muntakim in 1972 when I converted to Islam. My conversion was based upon a discussion that I had with two well-known leaders of the civil rights movement at the time. One was formerly named H. Rap Brown, who now is Jamil Al-Amin. Another one was and Jalil Malamine was, at the time, had been a member of SNCC and had been a member of the Black Panther Party. I think it was Informational Justice at one time at the Black Panther Party. And also another individual by the name of Max Sanford, who is now known as Muhammad Ahmed. And he was a leader of the RAM, Revolutionary Action Movement. And the three of us were locked in a prison, each waiting to go to trial, an isolated area. And these guys were, for me, were iconic. I was at the time, 20 years old, impressionable, still impressionable, of the leaders of the movement. And one thing that I saw them doing their prayers, and I didn't understand why, when we're supposed to be fighting, not praying. That was my understanding, my own infantile understanding of our struggle. Eventually, after about 6 months of debate and discussion, you know, they gave me another viewpoint, you know, in terms of spirituality. Then I converted and adopted this name. This particular case, the New York case, happened on May 21st, 1971, right, in Harlem Polo Grounds projects, right? Two officers was shot and killed. One was black, one was white, all right? There was alleged 2 days. Actually, what happened was that on May 19th, two officers was machine gunned, May 19th, in front of D.A. Hogan's house, right? Two police officers was machine gunned. And then on May 21st, two officers in the housing projects, Polo Grounds in Harlem, were shot and killed. All right. And then a day later, someone submitted or sent a letter to the news saying that the two acts was committed by members or by members of the Black Liberation Army. All right. This is the first time the name Black Liberation Army became public. All right. First time that it was notified, or the public was notified, that there was, in fact, a black underground in this country. On May 26th, the following week, J. Edgar Hoover was in the White House, had a sit-down with Richard Nixon, the president at the time, and various members of the Watergate plumbers, the guys who broke into Watergate, doing a Democratic cover-up, a Watergate cover-up, who were also some were ex-CIA members and other intelligence officers, had a meeting. And at that meeting, they decided that they were going to resolve this issue of these killings or the shootings in New York under the heading of the FBI, right? And they codenamed their operation New Kill. The word is an acronym for New York Killing, right? New Kill. All right, now New Kill essentially is a subset or a version of what was originally COINTELPRO, another secret operation. All right. We have memorandums and documents where FBI director informed the field office in New York to not inform the New York City Police Department that the FBI was engaged in this activity, was in fact under authority of the President of the United States to resolve this, to solve this killings, right, solve these murders. Until months later, where they had to inform them that the FBI was engaged in this, involved in this, when it started to be revealed to what degree that it was getting cooperation, the New York Police Department was getting cooperation from the FBI, right? It was unusual that a state case would have this type of cooperation for the federal government, all right? So New Kill was the cover up of a campaign by Richard Nixon, J. Edgar Hoover, and the plumbers to convict Panthers for this particular case, right? We learned later, after our conviction of New Kill, right, the attorney general, I'm not attorney general, the district attorney, during the course of trial, had documentations, New Kill documentations, that he withheld from the defense, right? According to the state law, they're supposed to, and what they call discovery, right, supposed to provide the defense with any documentation dealing with any type of police investigations of the case, so we would know better how to defend ourselves. The district attorney's office failed to do so, failed to turn off any documents coming from the FBI or anything that would indicate that it came from Nukeel. We have documentations that indicated at one point where our attorneys asked for discovery documents that the FBI made an inquiry. Did any of the documents that was turned over to defense show that there were Nukeel documents, right? And whether or not there would be any other future requests for documents, right? And because it didn't, they were relieved that the documents did not show that, okay? The DA, in fact, had these documents in his possessions and refused to turn them over, right? One particular document is extremely important that lends to the issues of innocence was the fact that the weapon that they claimed I was supposed to have used in this case was not the murder weapon, all right? They had a New York City ballistics officer named George Simmons testify. George Simmons testified that he was the only one that did ballistics exams, did ballistics tests, and had the possessions of the ballistic materials at all times. That's what he testified to, right? And that he's the one that made the match, right, in this particular case. Come to find out later, years later, that several of the ballistics material was sent to the FBI. And the FBI is the ones that did the testing. And they reported was inconclusive that the weapons and the bullets matched. The bullets from the officers' bodies and the gun, they said it was inconclusive that it was a match, right? In other words, in FBI speak, was there was no match. That was withheld. So essentially, I'm in prison for a weapon that is not the murder weapon in this case. And they knew it, and they withheld it, right? So that's Nukeel. For the most part, and trying to expose that. Another example of the cover-up is that we well know from the history of Richard Nixon's White House that he taped everything, right? That he taped all his conversations and even telephone conversations and meetings that they held at the White House. That's what got him in a lot of trouble behind the Watergate issue, right? And so we've been trying to find the tapes from the May 26, 1971 meeting, right? We even had a person go to the National Archives, Nixon's library, and ask for the Nukeel documents. And when the person asked the librarian to have these documents from May 26, 1971, she said, "Oh, you mean the Nukeel documents?" And the person was to get the document said, "Yes, that's the one we have." She said, "We don't have them." So that speaks volumes, you know. It tells you that they even knew what the documents were that we was looking for and apparently had orders to not disclose, to not give them up, all right? And so we find that there's all kinds of cover-ups and lies, and perjury, testimony that would happen in this case. Another example is that a guy who was part of the Panther movement by the name of Reuben Scott was tortured, viciously tortured, when he was arrested in Louisiana. And there's a dramatization of this torture on the internet called the Legacy of Torture. So anybody's interested, they can pull that up on the internet, The Legacy of Torture. And it talks about the three individuals who was tortured by the Louisiana Police Department and tried to turn them. And so Reuben was one of them. And during the second trial, the first trial of our case, in a hung jury, they could not convict anyone. So the second trial, they came up with Reuben Scott to come and testify. And Reuben, again, they broke him, right? They beat him for 5 days. They put him in a cell with a guy who was schizophrenic with the lights on 24/7. They used a cattle prodder on his body. They put needles in his testicles. They tortured this man into they can mold it into anywhere compliance that they could possibly get out of him to say anything that they want him to say. And so when he was going to testify on the second trial, he asked to see the judge, Judge Edward Greenfield. So I want to see the judge and let him know that I'm prepared to testify. And when he got into the judge's chamber, he told the judge specifically, listen, they are making me testify to what they want, to their story, right? And I do not want to testify. And the judge said, okay, I understand. And he sent this guy, the kid, back to the DA's office because he was under DA's authority at the time, right, because he was their witness. And then told the DA that their witness was wavering in his testimony. For 2 weeks, the judge withheld this information before telling the defense that Reuben Scott did not want to testify, that he was, what he was going to testify to was not the truth. All right? So they gave the DA's office and the cops who were in New Orleans, New York City cops who were in New Orleans watching him being tortured. They didn't do it, engage in the torture themselves, but they oversaw it. The judge put him back in their hands, and they basically told him, listen, we will send you back to Louisiana if you don't testify the way we want you to testify. All right? So that's the gist and part of the dynamics that happened in this case to gain, to get this conviction. Perjured testimony, witnesses been tortured, right? Withholding government documents, right? And a weapon that's not the murder weapon. What the hell am I still doing here? Okay? And it's due to the politics of the case, due to the politics of the history of struggle in this country. The issues of parole. Well, I've been going to parole since 2002. Right? When I first became eligible for parole in 2002. And ever since, I've been denied. Been denied 9 times already. The principal reason for my denial primarily is because of the opposition of the Police Benevolent Association. Police Benevolent Association have a policy that anyone who is convicted of killing or shooting a police officer never should be released from prison, right? That's their policy, that's their philosophy, okay? And they use every tactic they possibly can to make sure that individuals who go up for parole or eligible for parole are denied. All right. My situation is that I, in terms of my prison efforts being developed in prison, I have qualified for everything necessary to be granted release. All right. Everything. Right. Even my disciplinary record is not that bad. Okay. I admit to have certain disciplinary issues over the years, but they've been minor, nothing major, all right? So every time I go to the parole board, I'd be denied, you know, on the basis of the campaign by the PBA. PBA has a website up now, and the website is that anyone goes up to for parole, the people can sign. Go to the website and push a button and sign a form letter, get sent to the parole board demanding denial, all right? And then there also, there's individuals who do their own personal letters to the parole board, and many of them are vicious, you know, vicious, nasty, racist letters that they send to the parole board. So now the other thing is that one of the victims in my case, the family member, the Jones family, has repeatedly, at least a couple of times, written letters to the parole board stating that if, in fact, these individuals are guilty of what they did, that we forgive them, right, and we are petitioning the parole board to grant their release, right, myself and my co-defendant, Herman Bell. However, the parole board, for the most part, has ignored those letters from the family in support of my release. That's, you know, that's their discretion, right? But it lends to the idea that the parole board lends towards punitive retribution rather than forgiveness and rehabilitation, right? And that's a problem. So 2018 will be my 10th parole hearing. Although the 2016, every time you go to parole board, if you deny it, you hit 2 years, right? So you don't go back to another 2 years unless you get it reversed on appeal, right? And my 2016 is now currently in the court on appeal. We're waiting for a decision. If the decision is favorable, then I would be going back to the parole board perhaps before the end of the year, right, if it's favorable. If not, then I'll be going back. I'm scheduled for 2018, June 2018. I'm scheduled to go back to the parole board, and hopefully this interview and the others that I've had will be supportive of that, and will be able to allow me to counter the onslaught of the PBA's efforts to ensure that I do not be released, you know. Naturally, we believe in the power of the people, right? And that's our slogan, right? And I continue to believe that the power of the people will set me free, you know. That is the idea. But in order to do so, it's important for the people to know what this case is about. And that's the purpose for this interview. Well, there's a parole reform committees outside who has been very challenging the legislative branches of New York State government, recognizing that there's the system in and of itself. Some people say it's broken. I say it's working exactly the way it's supposed to work, right? That it has not been been adherent to is ideal as Department of Corrections, right? They have not been correcting anybody. And if they have been correcting anybody, they have not been releasing those people who have been corrected, okay? So that's the argument. If rehabilitation is part of the process of corrections, then we must be able to recognize that there's some point of end game, right? That a person has, in fact, been rehabilitated, and they should be released from prison, right? And so there has been some, the parole reform activities in New York State has been pretty successful. They've gotten rid of several more difficult parole commissioners, and there are some bills that's been up, that's been repressive bills have been up that they defeated, and it looks like that there's going to be a change in philosophy in regards to parole. The parole changed when we had Pataki administration. Our governor was of New York State, and he was a lot more repressive, and tried to prevent the release of people. And so that philosophy is starting to change, where now guys who are deserving to be released hopefully will be released. In fact, there was a guy next cell from me who was just granted parole after 41 years in prison. So we see some cracks in the walls, where they started to release some of the old timers who are more deserving to be released. And hopefully, next time I go, you know, with the support of the power of the people, right, I will be released as well.
You're listening to CFRC Prison Radio. We'll be back to this interview after a short musical break. Just a warning that there is a little bit of profanity in the song. We'll be right back.
New to the world, fresh out the barrio. I was an outlaw rebel, out of my mind young and wild. My existence defined in one word, survive.
If it could be sold, I could sell it. If it can't, that's cool. I fix it up, make it look good enough to catch some fools. It started when I was young, with my Genesis games. He traded me John Madden for, I don't remember the name, but it was Rico. The streets, though, they play with Perico. So Tito became my E-ho. He had cheap blow, and each O like 3-4 times I flip ones. But it's Evo, the people I deal with, a stick nuns. With big guns, they diesel, that diesel never changed. The custody still gnaw like they agree with A. The weed ain't the same, all the colors is new. It ain't just green, the A's is purple and them berries is blue.
I don't care if it was pink, as long as they still smoking. I had them bags packed till they damn near open. The hustle's in my veins, I could bleed in a pot and make a soup that'd go for $10 a pot.
In La Calle, on a collision course with incarceration, consumed by the lies of the streets. They were an illusion, but I awoke, caged like an animal.
They got me locked in a cell where I'm feeling like an experiment. My spirit sharper than lasers they used to build pyramids. Writing on the walls keep me sane. Knuckle push-ups on the concrete till I bleed out the pain. Thoughts of my freedom lingering in my brain. I'm stronger and much quicker. I appreciate the gain. Building with my air life. Brown power reunite. Tattoos of my flag. PR pride, Jesus Christ. But I wouldn't wish this on my worst enemy. So when I'm free, I'll teach and spread the speech. How they try to divide us, make us weak, find us and break a piece. So I got us making peace, honest. I play for peace. This is the life of your forefathers that fought hard on four corners of backyards. Power in numbers, so they subtract us and add bars. If they want it, we gon' take them to war. We not a gang or a clique, we young lords.
I came with my senses. Un esclavo no soy. That is now my past. I came to know me and my people. Red, brown, and black help me paint the future.
The world got a template to turn us into inmates, caged in a state pen, man. Fuck going to Penn State. Bondage and slave ships to punch in your time card. Walk my wasted space and jungle behind bars. Got my epiphany like Malcolm X. Prison to the bricks, but I'm stuck in this global house arrest. I'm a free man, so I changed my mannerisms. This Greenspan system wanna dead my activism. And Dilo Machetero, get my people out the ghetto. 21st century, grito de la destate ghetto. We vocal minorities, no Pokemon tail. Guess the local authorities, so we the Ho Chi Minh trail. For robbing bodegas and boosting like low lives. Media figures, token and 4-5. Revolutionary gangsters in your presence. Try to dead us with cancer through chemical testing.
Unidos por fin, we seize the time. Free at last. Learn to love, live to fight. Not just for me, but for others. Teach the new blood, yeah. And live for freedom.
I survived the coin toll, pro assassinations, AIDS epidemic, crack era, fracture the nation. The interpretation of American democracy is best exemplified in its foreign policy dichotomy.
That was Young Lords by Immortal Technique, featuring Joel Ortiz, CF Pumpkinhead, and Panama Alba. And Young Lords, of course, were another Puerto Rican liberation group, another group that was active in the 1960s and 1970s alongside the Black Panthers and the Black Liberation Army, and subsequently targeted by the FBI and COINTELPRO. We're going to get back to our interview that was done by a correspondent from CKUT Prison Radio in Montreal with Jaleel Muntakim. This is part two. This is CFRC Prison Radio.
So that's the just and part of the dynamics that happened in this case to get this conviction. Perjured testimony, witnesses been tortured, right? Withholding government documents and a weapon that's not the murder weapon. What the hell am I still doing here? And it's due to the politics of the case, due to the politics of the history of struggle in this country. And that lends to the idea of what? We are, in fact, political prisoners. And political prisoners exist in the United States, although they deny the existence of political prisoners. They deny that they have political prisoners. They, in fact, do prosecute those who are dissenters, those who dissent, right? But they prosecute them under the foundations or the basis of criminal proceedings. They criminalize political dissent, and therefore they can deny. What we call plausible denial? Plausible denial, because they've been convicted in the criminal court, right? But they're, in fact, political prisoners in the United States. I'm a little concerned about people trying to, in my opinion, water down, right, the idea to make it inclusive of everybody who's convicted of a crime based on the politics of the socioeconomic conditions, the politics of the United States, racism, white supremacy, and the whole bit, and the conditions of the social conditions that create an environment from which people will turn to criminality in order to survive. All right. My problems with that issue is that one of intent and one of their terms of their relationship to government. at large, right? So if anyone who's engaged in criminal activity or for self-aggrandizement, their survival, trying to make money, drug dealers, pimps, car thieves, robbers, and et cetera, and they're doing their activities or they're engaging in this criminal activity for the basis of personal survival, right, to make money or to get rich, or whatever the case may be, right, their relationship to the government is not politics, it's not political. And so we have certain individuals who try to deal with the issue or deal with the question of political prisoners and saying that they're inclusive because of the conditions of government oppression, government repression, right, socioeconomic conditions, and racism. However, political prisoners is deliberate, right? Those engaged in the politics of struggle is deliberate, right? It's self-sacrificing, right? Their understanding of the socioeconomic dynamics, society at large, is one of indeed one of repression and oppression. And they've taken a stand on that, right? So this conscious, deliberate activity on their part should not be diminished in terms of their commitment, right? And that's important. And so I maintain that we have to make a clear understanding between the two, social prisoners and political prisoners. Now, in terms of social prisoners who become politicized once they're in prison, again, here's a conscious determination, right? Now their relationship has changed between them and the institutions of oppression, right? Now they have become politicized. And on the basis of that relationship change and their consciousness in regards to that, they have, in fact, then become under the gamut of a political prisoner, right? So we have the politicized prisoners who become political prisoners. Then there are those in the streets who are activists in the streets and was engaging in the streets, trying to change social order in the streets, committed themselves, made self-sacrifices, into a point of maybe subjecting themselves to the ultimate sacrifice, right? And or been captured, sent to prison, they are indeed political prisoners and or prisoners of war, all right? And they should be recognized as such. Again, as mentioned earlier about the failure of recognition of U.S. political prisoners and the negligible support that we have, another analogy that I raise is the fact that many of us from back in the 60s and 70s were contemporaries of Nelson Mandela, right, and his struggle against apartheid. Well, our struggle is very similar. It was against Jim Crow. Very similar conditions, a very similar pathos of struggle, all right, both psychologically, culturally, socially, and politically, all right. However, by virtue of the ANC and the movement that was engaged, their success, right, people recognized Nelson and all those who was in Robben Island with him, right, as having been political prisoners. No such recognition is given to us, right? Perhaps that's because we were defeated, right? Or, again, our inability to create the kind of international solidarity that was successfully done for the movement of apartheid. One of the things that Malcolm made an argument was that, Malcolm X, made an argument was that if you continue to keep your struggle as a civil rights struggle, then it can be contained domestically as a domestic issue, right? And he made the argument that our struggle is for human rights. And when you struggle for human rights, it becomes international, right? It cannot be contained within the domestic politics of the government from which you're challenging. And so this is what I'm trying to do now, or have been doing for many of the years that I've been in prison, is to raise our understanding of our struggle is a question of human rights and more so than issues of civil rights. Yeah, 1996, I was at Eastern Correctional Facility and I put out the call for Jericho, right? Jericho originally started with the Provisional Government of the Republic of New Africa, right? They originally started having marches in Washington, D.C., calling for political prisoners, what they call Jericho March, under the biblical story of Jericho, and then the walls come tumbling down, right, with people with loud noises and blowing the horns around the kingdom, okay, and the walls came tumbling down. So that was the principal philosophy behind it. And in 1995, they stopped. RNA stopped having these marches in the White House. They were annual marches. And so in 96, I put out a call for them to be restated, restarted, right? My comrade, Sophia Bukhari, my dear comrade, Sophia Bukhari, and Herman Ferguson came to visit me. And they basically said, listen, Gilo, we cannot do this thing in a year's time, right? I said, we'll organize it. We believe this needs to be, but we need to work on it. And so it took 2 years in 1998. And in 1998, they were successful in organizing a national campaign that brought 6,000 activists from across the country to Washington, D.C. For the Jericho March and demonstration and rally. And it was so enthusiastic, successful, that we decided that we have to continue this. And on the basis of the needs for political prisoners, we started the Jericho Amnesty Movement in 1998. Next year will be the 20th anniversary of the existence of Jericho. And Jericho was able to, have been able to, raise the profile of political prisoners, both domestically and on the international platform. They've been to Geneva, Switzerland, and gave presentations to the United Nations on a couple of occasions in that particular time. They have established a legal defense fund for political prisoners. They have established a medical assistance committee for political prisoners. They established programs to assist family members to visit political prisoners. They have an annual fundraiser to get commissary funds and other things of that nature for political prisoners and over the years, and continue to raise the question of the existence of political prisoners in various forms and events so they won't be neglected or not be forgotten over the last nearly 20 years. There's more that can be done and should be done, of course, but the present chairman of Jericho, Jihad Abdul Mumet, former member of the Black Panther Party, former political prisoner, is committed to this this ideal, right, and committed to Jericho. Presently, there is under discussion a new proposal to have the international jurists to come and tour the United States and raise the questions of human rights abuses as pertains specifically to political prisoners. If we are successful in getting this done, it will be the second time we have the international jurors come to the United States. The first time I was able to have them, myself and others, was able to have them come was in 1980, I think it was. And it was based on my first campaign that I organized when I was in San Quentin and also in Attica. The first time a petition was submitted to the United Nations dealing with the issues of political prisoners and the existence and the conditions of U.S. prisons. It was the National Prisoners Campaign to petition the United Nations. And I started that back in 1977. An international jurist came to the United States. They interviewed several prisoners, political prisoners, right, and they reported to the United Nations that political prisoners, in fact, exist in the United States. Right? For some people who may recall back then, when Andrew Young was an ambassador to the United Nations, we had a journalist go to one of his press conferences in Paris and ask the single question. I asked to have that journalist ask the single question, does political prisoners exist in the United States? And Andrew Young answered affirmatively, quote, perhaps thousands, unquote. And for his admission of that truth, he was fired from his ambassadorship to the United Nations by then President Jimmy Carter. Right? There was a big hoopla behind him making that admission. When we consider again the question of the political prisoners, and we consider again Martin Luther King when he was arrested in Alabama, right? And he made one of his major statements written on toilet paper while he was in jail, his letter from a Birmingham jail. And if anybody ever gets the opportunity to read that, I suggest that they do so. Reading that particular document, you can look at it and see that it was basically a strategy. He's laying out a strategy of protest And it indicated for him at that time, he was letting people know at that time that he and others who was in prisons and in jails at that time were in fact political prisoners. So the history of our struggle is long and arduous, right? And I am only contributing to that, just one of the contributors of that in this continuum of struggle. And Jericho is just another institution towards those ends.
One last question about recognition and political prisoners. I know in lots of other places in the world, like in Ireland in the 1980s, pushing for political prisoner status meant pushing for a special kind of status within the prisons. Is that part of your vision about what pushing for that recognition would be about, or what does it mean in terms of like what would be about that recognition?
That's a good question. That would be ideal, right? But U.S. prison system, right, state and federal, is structured in such a way that makes that almost impossible. All right, we have an individual, for instance, myself and co-defendant Herman Bell, right, and other comrades like Robert Seth Hayes, right, we are prevented from being in the same institution, in the same prison. Now, what will that do if we were to make an argument that we all should be held in the same institution? Well, naturally, it would also create a condition for us to be under more scrutiny and restrictions, right? So then we have to fight that, right? I think we would rather put our attention and energy towards getting the hell out of penitentiary rather than trying to get recognition of being inside prison. So in areas, for instance, like Ireland, where it was a broad-based mass movement, right, against a recognized colonial power, British colonial power, and it was an extensive organizing, right, and a political party in support of that movement, of that struggle. They had the conditions from which they can make that kind of argument. Here in the United States, those conditions doesn't exist, right? And so I don't see the need to put forth that kind of energy at this point in time, when we really should be concentrating on how in the hell to get out of prison. Now, if by chance or by deliberate action, right, we are capable of building the kind of support base, mass support for political prisoners, right, and including the demand for their amnesty and release that Jericho has consistently been making, perhaps we can create that kind of argument and fight to have them brought together. Another interesting point was that during the National Prisoners Petition Campaign to the United Nations, it was so successful. After I talked about Andrew Young at making that admission, Fidel Castro made an offer to trade our political prisoners with some prisoners they had in Cuba. All right. That was in December of 1979 or 1980. He made that offer. Unfortunately, we did not have in place the individuals who was able to challenge the State Department to make that exchange, right? But Fidel eventually, during that time, did exchange some prisoners with some other captives, right? They did make some kind of exchange. Unfortunately, we were not included. And that lends to, again, to my argument that the weakness of the support base for political prisoners in the United States. You know, if our support base was stronger, we could have made that happen. And that's one of the reasons why we continue to fight, and Jericho continue to try to represent us both on a national and international level. Back in 1979, myself and two other prisoners in Greenhaven, we filed a petition in the United States District Court condemning or challenging the 13th Amendment of the United States Constitution. And it was the first formal civil rights petition that was submitted to the courts on that particular issue. And we also submitted the document to a form of the document to the United Nations, right, and try to get them involved and engaged. Ultimately, we lost. What we were trying to do is get that clause in the 13th Amendment removed where it says slavery and involuntary servitude shall not exist in the United States except for those who have been duly convicted of a crime, right? So what we find is that slavery in the United States was never abolished, right? It was institutionalized, right? They ended the private holding of slaves, but institutionalized the state holding a slave. And so on the virtue of that history in and of itself, what we're finding is that mass incarceration is a perpetuation of the idea of the holding of individuals as slaves, right? And by the history of this country, we also see that who they are, based upon their history, the majority of individuals who are in prison are Black and Latino, people of color, all right? So this isn't conforming to the history of this country. There has been, again, a continuum. And as I mentioned earlier about white supremacy and the efforts to resurrect the Confederates, that continuum, that fight from the Civil War continues 150 years later. It's been non-ending, particularly as it affects Black people, right? After the Civil War, they had the Black Codes. And then Black Codes turned into Jim Crow. And Jim Crow turned into mass incarceration, right? And this is a form of repression, right? To deny the human rights of people of color, especially Black people in this country. And so when we look at the issues of mass incarceration in the broader picture of history of this country, we can see that continuum. Well, who's gonna deny him? Who's gonna deny want to abolish prison? You know? So I mean, that's not even one thing for consider. What is considered is how, right? Naturally, prison in and of itself is big business, right? It's been monetized, okay? Just as slavery was monetized, and so in order to abolish prison, you have to create an alternative to that monetization, right? And that in and of itself creates a whole new level of consciousness amongst people. Our thinking has to change in terms of redistribution of wealth in this country, right? We know that one of the principal reasons for people coming to prison is due to poverty. So, can we get rid of poverty? And if that's a part of the process of abolishing prison, then that's the way we need to go. Okay. So we find that abolishing the prison has to be abolishing the whole capitalist society, capitalist system. All right. We have to change our mythology of appropriation and redistribution of wealth in this country. You cannot do one without the other. Right, because it is, in fact, a part of the corporate entity of the social order. Right, so when we talk about abolition of prisons, of course we're down with that, right? Just as much as we're down with the ending of capitalist imperialism. Now, the methodology and how you do it, how you go about doing it, I have a problem with them making the argument of abolishing prison without also including the argument of destroying capitalist imperialism, right? You cannot do one without the other, right? They are interlinked and tied to one another because they're part of the monetized system of capitalism, right? You have corporations who are invested in prisons. So that means you have to challenge those corporations. We have to stop the monetization of prisons in order to abolish it. So you can scream and holler as much as you want about abolishing prison, but if you're not challenging the corporations that are invested in prison, those corporations that are in the stock market, on Wall Street, that are invested in prison, if you're not challenging them, then you're spitting in the wind and it's blowing back in your face, all right? Your vision and your idea of what you are up against is screwed, You know, it's incoherent to reality, right? In fact, you're delusional. You know, I'm gonna put it that way. You're delusional. If you can think you can abolish prison and not destroy and not abolish capitalist imperialism, right?
You've been listening to CFRC Prison Radio on 101.9 FM. For more information about Jaleel's case, visit freejaleel.com. Our website is cfrcprisonradio.wordpress.com. Our call-in number, where you can leave a voicemail, is 613-329-2693. You can email us at cfrcprisonradio@riseup.net, and you can write us at CPR, care of CFRC, Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario, K7L3N6. We'll see you next Wednesday at 7 o'clock for Calls from Home. This is Malcolm Garvey Huey by Dead Prez. Warning, there's a bit of swearing in this one. Take care. Have a good night.
Malcolm Garvey Huey.
Dedicated to all political prisoners.
Life was like a movie. Study Malcolm Garvey Huey. Malcolm Garvey Huey.
It's Gates the Grill. Gates Bad.
Life was like a movie.
Free Bolivia.
I die. I organize. Everything I do's revolutionize. I build what's good for the whole damn hood. Study G's like these. Really think you should. I study Malcolm Garvey Huey. Malcolm Garvey Huey. Marcel Cody with the Uzi. Listening to Fela Kuti. I'm a goon with the machete. Especially if it's deadly, got the Santos for the Hexy to protect me, so respect me. This is heavy, legendary, revolutionary. My wifey, she resurrect me when they thought they had me buried. Took me out the cemetery, now it's family over every. Cause that's all that's necessary to avoid the commissary. I'ma live for you five, so I stop getting high. If you know, then you recognize it's that black and brown pride. This the power of the mind, RBG, God divine. You can see through the lies if you could read between the lines. I live, I die. I organize everything I do, revolutionize. I build what's good for the whole damn hood. Study G's like these, really think you should. Study Malcolm Garvey Huey. Study Malcolm Garvey Huey. Malcolm Garvey Huey.
Malcolm Garvey Huey, Bungie, Bobby, Pac, and Dookie. Sitting by the door so you can say I'm acting spooky. Just like in the movie, son, you better pack your toolie. Niggas wish be acting fruity, you'll be cracking like they pookie. Rather smoke a doobie then be burning and eluding. Bang, bang, pig shooting. We should blame Rudy Julie. Yanny for the camera, shine a white and nose candy. Let you banging on the system. You a gangster wearing panties. RBG, my family from the Bronx to Miami. Police cannot stand me. Pacquiao like a Manny. Call me little Bobby Hutton, cause I'm first to push the button. Rappers don't be saying nothing to the system. We say fuck 'em. This is for Nahanda, Mama C, Mama Akua. All the real OGs, I'm a soldier, cause you told me study Malcolm Garvey. Malcolm Garvey Huey. Malcolm Garvey Huey. I'm reporting in the duty.
Sticky, icky, yours truly here for duty. Don DeVito, M.A. Uno, you know how we drop the jury. This is real, not a movie, not Mickey, Donald, Goofy. I'm a soldier, I avoid a bitch nigga like the cooties.
School face in a hoodie.
Fresh pair of khakis, we could do this like we fam. I go to war like the Apaches. For whatever, I stay ready. I learned that in Tallahassee. Baba Toon, they used to school me as a juvie. Skipping classes, never let the system use me. My duty is my passage. Watch the homies in your army. They don't always show their badges. Keep your family living healthy. Teach your children about their blackness. Teach your wifey how to use the ratchet. This shit is classic. Get your food, clothes, and shelter. Fuck the system, pimp it backwards. I ain't hating, I'm just saying. If you wanna be a rapper, study
Malcolm Garvey Huey. Malcolm Garvey Huey. Study Malcolm Garvey Huey. Malcolm Garvey Huey. Study Malcolm Garvey Huey. Malcolm Garvey Huey. Study Malcolm Garvey Huey. Malcolm Garvey Huey.
A tactical approach is designed to get certain results. It's designed to keep you alive. It's designed to bring about victory.